Welcome back to Fear or Favour. Nazir, how's your week been?
I'm absolutely fine. You, this time of year, you're getting board meetings after... I'm on a lot of boards. And in the old days, you'd go to a room and you'd sit around a table with a group of people. But board meetings online just do not have the flavour of a proper meeting, to be frank. In a board meeting, you'd have the odd nodding head. You'd know if you're getting some approval from somebody. You can't get that online. You're missing out on so much. But it looks like we're going to be like this for quite a while to go.
So I've had a busy week. I've been up to a university college up in the north of England. I do these occasionally, like motivational speaking, and I also have to book them a long way in advance. But I just feel it's really important sometimes to... These people are just starting their journey to work very soon. And I think it's important to give them kind of an understanding of what I've experienced through my lifestyle and my life experiences.
You're a role model.
Do you know, it's interesting. I did get asked that question. One of the pupils said to me, who was your role model when you grew up? And I said, well, you know, from a role model point of view, I was very much involved with rugby. So my role models were the likes of Zinzan Brooke, and you know, those key rugby players, really. But I did say to them, you know, who are your role models now? And it was interesting because it was very much social media based.
I know. And that's troubling, isn't it, a little bit? What have they done?
So this week, we're going to talk about two cases that are currently in the headlines. I think it's really important to give our view in respect of that. But before we do so, I am going to just give a warning that we will be talking about acts of violence in relation to child abuse. I think it's really important that we do cover some of the elements of that. We're going to talk about the murder of 6-year-old Arthur Labinjo Hughes, and then we're going to talk about the current prosecution side in relation to the Ghislaine Maxwell court case. Let me just give some background in relation to Arthur's case. So Arthur's mum was jailed for an unrelated homicide. And on the 23rd of March 2020, he moved in with Emma Tustin and his dad, Thomas Hughes. They already had two children living at the house who were their own children. In April, paternal grandmother noticed bruising on Arthur's back, called the emergency number. Social workers visited. Their assessment was that Arthur was okay, he was having a good life, and that the household was safe and there were no safeguarding concerns. What's now materialised is that Gran at that point did offer to send a photograph that she'd taken of Arthur's back, but the social workers didn't want to see it. They carried out actually their own examination, they say, and whilst they saw some faint bruising, they didn't see the injury that the grandmother reported. 3 months after moving into the house, Arthur was rushed to hospital. Fatal head injury. He'd been hit so violently against the wall and the floor, it resulted in his death. On the day of his death, he'd also been given a lethal dose of salt by Tustin. His injuries amounted to 130 in total. Nazir, a shocking case.
Yeah, I mean, both of us have seen the worst of humanity, but nothing prepares you for when a child is murdered. You know, we've dealt with those cases. They stay with you forever. And in Arthur's case, the people who were most meant to be caring for him, the people he looked to for love and support, were the people ultimately that caused his death. And, of course, there are some videos, aren't there, which were played in the courtroom of Arthur saying how unloved he felt, how weak he was, and how ultimately the people who should have looked after him didn't. And, you know, I can't begin to tell you how horrifying that must have been for him and for his extended family. And also, the tragedy is that it will be repeated. You know, we don't seem to learn from these mistakes. I prosecuted Baby P, which was another child that was murdered by carers in the late 2008, 2007, that period. And it caused a similar outcry where people were saying, this can't be allowed to happen in our country. This can't be allowed to happen in our world. And unfortunately, I knew, as we all know, it'll be repeated because those who are meant to be safeguarding, and not just the carers, I'm talking about the authorities, don't seem to be able to get their hands on tackling these issues. They always use the phrase, lessons will be learned. Mark, how many reports have you seen where they say, well, lessons will be learned, and the fact that there is another offer tells you those lessons aren't learned?
Emma Tustin was sentenced to 29 years, convicted for murder, 10 years also for child cruelty, and Thomas Hughes, Arthur's father, was convicted for manslaughter, 21 years. The judge's view was that whilst this was premeditated, it wasn't to the degree of murder, and that formation that she had in relation to killing Arthur took place while she was assaulting him. Just explain, why wasn't Hughes also convicted of murder?
Well, he wasn't present at the time. I think the evidence before, well, the evidence before the court was that he told her to harm him, but it can't be proved beyond reasonable doubt that what that meant was, you know, finish him, kill him, and so the threshold wasn't met in relation to him. There are people might have a different different view of that. Unfortunately, that is the view the jury takes. That's the view the judge takes. And the sentence has to be.
And it's now been referred to the Attorney General, hasn't it? That within 28 days of sentencing, you can appeal. And in fact, anybody can. Members of the public can appeal to the Attorney General for a case to be looked at. So they've now referred that to the Attorney General, and she has now taken that on.
Yeah, the Attorney General is required. You can't appeal a sentence yourself. Only the Attorney General can do that on behalf of the public. It's very rare. It has to be what they call unduly lenient. What that means is it has to be so lenient that no court could have given the sentence. And I think this is why it's problematic. 29 years is quite a long sentence for murder. Mm. In fact, it's up there with some of the longest sentences.
And in fact, there was aggravating factors included, because I think the starting point was the 25 with the aggravating factors.
That's right. That's right. So I would be surprised, whether the Attorney General refers this to the Court of Appeal for review of the sentence. But, it's possible. At the end of the day, it doesn't bring Arthur back, does it? We've already been learning in the last few days that the two murderers, or murderer and manslaughterer, are having an uncomfortable time in prison, and a lot of people would be clapping their hands at that. I couldn't possibly comment, but I think it's important to know that justice has been
done. I hope they live with that. I mean, I don't know whether they are these type of people, but I hope they live with that torment every day that they wake up, and every time they shut their eyes, they see Arthur.
Do you know, we're rational beings. And I think we're caring beings. I can't begin to think how you can allow a six-year-old child to starve to death whilst you're beating them on a regular basis, denying him any pleasure, any joy, any love. We've discussed previously whether evil exists. I personally don't think evil exists, but I do believe that people can be so insensitive and irrational and unloving that they're capable of this kind of act. So I can't imagine, Mark, that they're sitting in their cells thinking, they're probably regretting being caught, regretting being sentenced, but not regretting what they did, because they did it.
And did it very deliberately over a period of 3 months. A very short period of time they were in the care. Arthur was in their care. I think one of the things that really stands out for me is the fact that they kept video recordings of it. They sent text messages. There was CCTV footage. Yeah. I mean, the CCTV footage allowed the court to see that over a period of 3 days, Arthur was caused to stand for 14 hours, 12 hours, and then 11 hours. That stand in the hallway to attention whilst the rest of the family got on. That's absolutely horrific, but so compelling to see such evidence at a trial.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it suggests sadism, doesn't it, on their part? So sadistic in their approach to poor Arthur. And the fact they filmed and they shared messages about him. Again, we're trying to rationalize the irrational here, where these people have done something so heinous that you know, you and I, we're not wicked enough to even think like they think, you know? I think there's something to be said about closure here. The extended family have got justice. Poor Arthur, obviously, you know, he's gone. Again, a sort of almost a footnote to this case is that Arthur's body is still in a mortuary. He's not been buried yet because...
I saw you tweet that. Yeah. And actually, the relatives, whichever one it is, have now agreed for Arthur's body to be released. But yeah, I saw your tweet basically saying that it's horrific. You know, that their torment, the family's torment continued. And poor old Arthur lays in a mortuary, unable to be laid to rest.
In a fridge.
Yeah.
I mean... It just beggars belief. As I said, it's now resolved or about to be resolved. But for all that time, you know, when you could have hoped that at least he would have been able to move on, or you know, the body would have been put in the ground, or you know, however else they wanted to celebrate his life, I guess. But you know, it tells you a lot about the dysfunctional natures of families as well. I mean. Almost as a footnote, you said at the outset that his mother is in prison for murder. You know, that would have been a big red flag for me, actually. You know, the fact that his mother's now he's living with father and stepmother. This goes back to the point about what the authorities' role in this is, or was, or should have been. You know, I think that they should have seen him as a high risk of violence, a high risk of harm. And they didn't. You know, they treated
him. Well, let's see what the authorities did. So the authorities, so social workers went to visit Arthur 2 months before his death. And this was as a result of his paternal gran contacting the authorities and saying that he's got this bruising to his back, offering to send a photograph. The authorities said, we don't need to see it. They did go and see Arthur. They say they checked the bruise on his back and it was a very faint bruise. However, there is a photograph taken 4 days after that visit when Arthur was in the bath, and that bruise is very visible. So it begs the question, either their examination was extremely poor or the evidence they're providing is not correct. And what of the role of the police? Well, the police in April went to see Arthur as a result of a concern. They did speak to the parties, and in fact, I think there was a video that was circulating in relation to that conversation. As a result of that, the officer was offered to be sent a photograph. She saw the photograph, referred it to her supervisor. Her supervisor subsequently put the incident down to not being suitable for their force response, and it should be dealt with by social services or public protection. For me, we've now got children's services, social workers going out to the address. We've got police attending the address and speaking. Yet nobody seems to have raised those flags to say, what is it that's going on within this family? None more so than, why is it this child's not at school?
Yeah.
Why? What is the background to this child in terms of how long that child's been living there? And at no stage was Arthur spoken to alone. It raises some of those broader issues of, why are we back here again? You know, you've talked in terms of Victoria Climbier. You know, Victoria's death in 2003, 128 separate injuries, hypothermia, malnourishment, restricted movement. That raised those concerns. And we go back further. We go back to when this very started, as far as public inquiries go, back to Maria Colwell in 1973, and raised at that point was the fact of, why were children dying when they were under the protection, as Maria Colwell was, of children's services? You know, I work in this field every day, and many people would just see me as a TV presenter, but I still very much am a practitioner. I look after a number of organisations and authorities where I do investigations in relation to allegations of child abuse, and I also do an awful lot of risk assessments on dangerous offenders. And one of the things that worries me, and I see it from a practitioner's level, is depending on where you live in the country will dictate the response that you get. So if you are in an area where there is a high amount of reporting of allegations of child abuse or concerns, you have to reach a higher level than if you're in another area of the country where reports are less.
It's the postcode lottery. We get this for domestic abuse, we get this for sexual violence, you get this for child protection. You get a different level of service depending on a different place or different location. A different quality of service, never mind the level of service. And what's troubling is what you've described in terms of the 50-year journey of child protection is whilst we are further forward, we've gone backwards over the last 10 years. Really have gone backwards over the last 10 years. And that, you know, demand has now totally outstripped resources. So one of the things that you mentioned this, whether the social workers were competent or incompetent or not asking the right questions. In 2010-11, the average social worker had 18 children to look after on their caseload. Today, that's about 40 children. It doesn't mean there are more children at risk. It means there aren't enough social workers or children, people in children's service to do their job. So you've got twice as many children to look after, different levels of risk, different levels of harm. I can see what's happening here. And we mustn't forget the other elephant in the room, which is lockdown. Mm. So this is the COVID lockdown, where you may not necessarily have the ability to go to somebody's house in the way that you previously could. And similarly, neighbors may not necessarily know what's going on next door. They don't see the child. You mentioned, you know, a child not going to school. Well, you know, schools were, sometimes they were open, sometimes they weren't open. So I think that all of those factors have played a part. We'll obviously look at the government have called for a national inquiry, and there will be an inquiry in relation to what happened to Arthur, particularly in that period when perhaps people could have acted differently. But I think we have to recognize that regardless of what you or I say, that there will be another child death next week or a week after. And the responsibility for that lies with those who cause it. We must never blame the authorities. They have responsibilities. But
the question is, can we do more? And are we doing enough? You know, as authorities, are they carrying out their role? Because at the end of the day, the authorities, and I always say this, you know, I know there's often an outcry and says, you know, people should be held to account for what's taken place. And to a degree, I totally agree with that, because I think when you take on the role of a police officer or a social worker and you are frontline, it is a big responsibility. You have that responsibility to pass that concern on. And if you fail to pass that concern on and something happens, then you need to ask yourself serious questions. Did I do it right? Could I have done something differently? And I think all those people involved in this, I would hope, are asking themselves
I have no doubt they will be. It'll be difficult for them to sleep. They'll be thinking about all the things you described earlier about what happened to Arthur, because they're good people at heart. That their job is to protect children. That's what they've chosen. As you chose your career, you know, in many respects, I did the same. They chose a career which was about safety and dealing with or protecting the most vulnerable. I think. You can only do so much if given whatever your caseload may be. You have to prioritize risk. I would hope that a six-year-old boy with the kinds of background that Arthur had would have been high risk, and you would have stepped in there and dealt with it and protected him. But at the end of the day, they failed to do that. You know, one of the things we're very bad at in this country is our response to issues like this. I look back at the ones I dealt with in the late 2010, that period. This is what we do. We firstly call for a head to roll. We want the head of social services, children's services, he must be sacked because they're held accountable. The second thing that happened, and this happened immediately after Baby P, was that the government said that now there would be a brand new risk assessment process. We could no longer allow you social workers to make a judgment here. It has to be done using this brand new risk tick box risk assessment tool. Now, let me tell you, Mark, you'll know this. No tick box has saved anybody's life. Yes. Right. The third thing that happened in the immediate aftermath of that, now you had this brand new tool. You were telling social workers they could no longer use their judgment. The social workers left the profession in their droves. Hundreds, if not thousands, left. And then in the year after this brand new process, with the new leadership, more children were killed by carers than ever before. So we're really bad. We always have this instinctive knee-jerk reaction. Rather than thinking, how can we improve things, we think we should start again. And unfortunately, starting again, we've got bad record of starting again.
The problem is it's the same mistakes being made. That's the problem. When you look back in those cases in the past, 1973, Maria Colwell, Baby Peter Connolly, Daniel Pelka, you know, these cases have all raised the issue in regards to make sure you see the child, make sure you have community relationships so that you are sharing information, make sure you record it appropriately. They've all resulted in inquiries. And in fact, the media play an important role because as a result of this, it does put it back into the public's agenda, child abuse and an awareness. But of course, what it also does is it then focuses on the very authorities, the gatekeepers, as it were, who are there to identify and safeguard children. And the problem is that as a direct result of that, the very good people in the organisations, those authorities who are doing a very good job on day to day, the pressure mounts on them.
Yeah, they take on more responsibility because they don't want anybody to be harmed. And you've described it. I mean, as I say, we know what works. What works is information sharing. So if somebody, one agency or one individual knows something or heard something or sees something, they share that information. We know that works. We also know, and this is what we're really bad at as well, listening to the child, him or herself. Mm. Time and time again, you go to the carer and you ask the carer, can you explain what happened here, what bruise? And they give an explanation. And time and time again, you walk away and accept that explanation. You don't take the child away for a brief moment to a safe place, give them confidence and trust so that they can disclose potentially what happened to them. You can't do that in the sight of the parent or the carer, because they're scared. The whole point is power and control. So we don't listen to children. We don't have mechanisms in place that will enable us to listen to children effectively. We don't share information. We're not curious enough. We're not curious enough. And at the same time, our systems aren't built to save lives. Our systems are process driven. Success is measured on the fact that they've followed their process. What they'll say is, well, we did everything that we say in our guidelines we should have done, rather than success being measured by the fact that we saved his life.
And I think that natural inquisitiveness, that position where you're going, I'm not going to take your word for granted, I'm going to make more inquiries. The problem with that is it's on the flip side. So whilst on the one level we're saying children's services, police need to be more inquisitive, they need to strike quicker, they need to take children away from environments when there's a potential risk, you then go to 1987 and the Cleveland inquiry. And the Cleveland inquiry very clearly set out that the issues around that was that it was an overzealous response by social workers in taking children away from their family. And yes, it was caused very much by two doctors who gave their assessment in terms of what they felt was assaults, which were non-accidental. But the aspect is that we then go full circle, because what the Cleveland inquiry said is, don't take children away. And then we have another scenario where a child dies and they go, why didn't you take that child away?
You can't win.
And it is a difficult balance. I'm a practitioner in the field. I work with social workers and police officers all the time. And it is difficult. And I can tell you, 99% of them do an amazing job on a day-to-day basis. Yeah. And you know that yourself, Nazir.
Yeah.
And it is this one case that goes wrong. And I'm sure those social workers that went there, and when they did look at the child, and I'm sure they did, but they didn't do it properly, if they'd have just spent a bit longer and they'd have done it a bit more thoroughly, could they have saved that child?
We won't know, but I imagine the answer to that question was yes, they could have. One of the things you mentioned a moment ago about, offenders generally, but particularly child offenders and sex offenders, they lie, and they lie for England. They are really good. I wonder whether or not, I mean, this might be quite controversial, whether polygraph testing has a greater role here. We all know, polygraph helps police and probation, for example, manage domestic abusers, sex offenders, and even now terrorist suspects, subjects lie detector tested, polygraph tested, to enable the truth about whether their behavior has changed. Very often people will say, I've changed, and we accept they've changed, rather than maybe looking at some forensic way, a scientific way of being able to. I mean, it's not 100% foolproof, but it gives you a really good idea.
I think it's a really good idea. And actually, I was quite a skeptic of lie detector polygraph tests for a long time. And then I did a bit of work around it. And actually, I worked with a company that did a lot of these tests just to examine and see whether they worked. And it was around the time that there was a consideration to use them in probation for sex offenders whilst they were in the community to see if they were continue to offend. And of course, crucially, if they told the truth. And what came out of that was that they were incredibly effective.
Yeah.
And I also was speaking to a colleague of mine who works over US law enforcement. And he was saying they've been using it for a very long time. Of course, it's evidential law in America, certain parts of America. It can't be used in the UK in a court. But for an intelligence gathering purposes, I think it's a brilliant idea. And it's, to my knowledge, not used in safeguarding child protection cases.
It's not.
It's a good idea.
I think it's something that they should be testing. They should be trialing. Mm. It works. I think it will work in child cruelty as it does in all the other areas. As long as you accept, it's not 100% foolproof. And I'm glad you used the word intelligence. It may not necessarily give you the evidence, but it'll give you enough to be able to then go and see what else you can find to substantiate or otherwise your particular
Absolutely.
View.
I mean, done right, they are very effective, and Absolutely. They certainly provide significant information that you wouldn't get if done right.
I've little doubt if they'd done it in this case, they'd have found out these parents were lying, and they may have taken Arthur to a safe place.
No, absolutely. You talked about lockdown earlier. Absolutely right, because during the lockdown, the NSPCC said that it was a 19% increase as a result of calls to them around concern. And it's quite obvious because children and families are living under the same roof for a long period of time.
Yeah, there's nowhere for them to go. If you'd go to school and maybe report to your teacher or to a school nurse or somebody, but of course the school's not open and you're not able to leave home. Where can you report this? And maybe they don't have access to online portals that will give them, security advice, safety advice, or help them that way. So yeah, I have little doubt that lockdown has had an impact. And never mind the numbers, real children have been harmed.
And one of the things taking that to a next level is the amount of children who didn't go back to school or who don't attend school regularly now.
Yeah.
The figures are unknown. They anticipate and estimate it's around 90 to 100,000 people. That's young children who are not attending school on a regular basis. And the question for me is, why on earth don't schools know that? Why on earth don't local authorities have those figures? And you may say, well, hang on a minute, this has only come about as a result of this. This has been raised so many times before. So in 2011, Dylan Seabridge died as a result of scurvy, aged 8. And at that point in time, he hadn't been seen by anybody for 7 years. He was being homeschooled.
Yeah.
Nobody in the authorities had seen him for 7 years. That is absolutely unacceptable. And what about those 90 to 100,000 children who are not attending school? Who may well themselves have completely dropped off.
This is quite political, actually, because I did actually, a few years ago, try and talk to ministers about putting some restrictions. At the very least, having a register of homeschool children.
Yeah.
So you knew where they were. And then now and again, you could turn up on the door, knock on the door. Is your child being schooled? Is your child here? And unfortunately, the obstacle I faced was that actually a lot of middle-class parents are the ones that are homeschooling, and they were absolutely aghast at the idea that they might have to fill in a register. They were aghast at the idea that they might be inspected, and of course their MPs then decided that they wouldn't support the idea either. So it became political. Let's keep the politics out of it. We're not asking that every single child be inspected on a daily basis. What we're saying, what I'm saying, is that you have a national register where you put your child on in terms of homeschooling. You then tell on that register, you put down what level of curriculum you're putting, so you can make sure they're being properly educated. And you're also available for the odd ad hoc knock on the door to make sure that everything is in order. And I think that's not a lot. That is not so onerous that we're saying you can't homeschool.
and provide it and say that, you know, once a year you'll get a visit.
Yeah.
So, you know, at the least. And I think one of the things about this is political, you're absolutely right, but it's also financially driven. You know, what are the resources that are going to be applied to this? And one of the things that could very easily work are using the voluntary individuals. So retired social workers, retired educational welfare officers, retired teachers, to go into their local community and go and visit these people.
Yeah.
I think we've got to be more joined up. We've got to think about this in a much more long term, because what happens is we have reviews, we look at it, we look at the immediacy of it, and then it all gets forgotten. So for today, we're talking about 90 to 100,000 children who aren't at school. But we were talking about that for the last 10 years. Yeah. Why has nobody affected that and put that in place? And I call upon some of these people who have bigger roles to do. You know, the Children's Commissioner. Why on earth is the Children's Commissioner not got this as their number one priority? And before they leave office, get this working. Yeah. Why are the NSPCC not leading on something like this? I'm sorry, we're far too, we knee-jerk, we respond to crisis, but we're very poor at long-term strategy.
No, I agree entirely. I think we need, you know, the national review the government have now announced in the aftermath of Arthur's murder should look at these issues. You know, it shouldn't just be about whether Arthur could have been saved or not. It's whether every one of those children you've mentioned that could have been saved, and whether or not going forward, you know, we're always firefighting. Let's not firefight. Let's plan as to how we're going to ensure that our children are kept safe.
And I think that's where we've got to in terms of social working and police. So policing and social working now is very much about firefighting, and that by me, you know, obviously the fire happens, they respond. So the crisis happens, they respond, rather than thinking, what can we do that stops that fire starting in the first place?
Yeah.
But that causes resources. That means you've got to have a planning. Money. You've got to have a plan, but it saves lives.
Down the line, it saves money, never mind lives. I mean, you know, you just think, you know, for example, we use the analogy of firefighting. You know, most houses now are better designed, so the number of fires has gone down across the country, across the world, and certainly across the developed world, have gone down because the houses have alarms, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah.
So you ultimately, never mind saving lives, you're saving the economy, you're ensuring that people can be more productive, all of those things, by doing these preventative things. And we seem to love responding to a crisis rather than preventing harm. I just don't get that. I just don't understand it.
Well, we're talking about Arthur, but 55 children died last year as a result of maltreatment. That's 54 people we didn't know about.
No, it just shocks. I mean, it shocks me to the core. You end up looking at your own children and thinking they're but for the grace of God, you know. So, you know, I don't know what it takes to kill a child or why you'd want to do that. You know, it shows a complete and utter neglect and weakness and wickedness. But at the same time, as I say, we could save more lives.
Yeah. Well, let's move on from talking about Arthur. And let's move on to the next thing to talk about. So Ghislaine Maxwell, her trial is ongoing in America. She's up for 8 counts of sex trafficking and other charges relating to her role, accused in relation to recruiting and grooming girls for Epstein for abuse between 1994 and 2004. Of course, she denies all of the charges. It's quite interesting what's been going on.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, it's not. I mean, it doesn't surprise me. I mean, you and I have both dealt with sex abuse allegations in our careers, and so some people who are new to this, who've never seen one before or never watched a trial as it unfolds, are shocked. I mean, the one that struck me was that one that said the prosecution are making all these terrible mistakes. These alleged victims are inconsistent in the way that they're putting their stories across. I said, I cannot think of a victim in my life that was ever consistent.
No.
The nature of sexual abuse or abuse of any kind is that you're often so traumatized by it that when you account for it, when you talk about it in a trial, it comes out in dribs and drabs. Yeah, you remember something or you forget something. The point, that is the whole point of these types of crimes. But these observers who've never seen a case like this are somehow pointing to these inconsistencies as if the prosecution are fumbling. I think that was one word that was used. They're fumbling. No, the prosecution are presenting their case, warts and all. There will be weaknesses, there will be strengths. And they are doing so, and at the same time, the people who are accusing Ghislaine Maxwell will say something today that they didn't say in a statement before, or say something tomorrow that they didn't say today. That's just the nature of these types of crime. At the end of the day, what the jury will be looking for is whether they can believe them. And they, I've been inconsistent with what I said 30 minutes ago. That's just the nature of humanity, I'm afraid.
It's quite interesting because there's a couple of elements. One is that I thought that we'd get more coverage in the UK of the case.
Mm.
It seems to be massively covered in the US. And I think the general census, if you looked across the media coverage in the US, is that it's one of fairly critical against the prosecution's case, saying that they haven't been very good in their preparation of the victim's witnesses, hasn't been good in terms of their evidence overall. Of course, there's four complainants in relation to this, three that are giving evidence. One of those that isn't giving evidence, that hasn't been called, is somebody that's featured quite significantly in the UK press, in particular in relation to Prince Andrew, and that's Virginia Roberts Giffrey. That she isn't appearing and isn't giving evidence. What's your thoughts about that?
I'm just guessing. We don't know. At the end of the day, when I prosecuted cases, and I might have had several alleged victims, I make a judgment about my strongest case and present my strongest case. Additionally, if certain people are, some of the people I've dealt with, sadly, and you will have dealt with, are mentally health challenged, they're traumatized by what's happened to them. Do you want to re-traumatize them by putting them into the witness box? There's all sorts of factors that will play in the prosecutor's mind about whether somebody should be called to give evidence or not. I think the defense will obviously have a similar decision to take when they decide how to present their case, present their evidence. So I think it's really important to not put too much onto that. It is a judgment call that needs to be made by those who know what's going on. And the broader point that you made, actually, Mark, about whether or not the media over here are paying attention. They do. Every time the word Prince Andrew is mentioned in the transcript, suddenly that day it's all over the newspaper.
The one thing that's been massive this week over here is that photograph, isn't it?
Yeah, 100%. The photograph of Balmoral. I mean, the fact that she has been where she went tells you, how well connected they were. I mean, they were extraordinarily well connected. So I think we have to realize
that that's the one thing that jumped out at me when I saw it. And I thought, you're pretty connected if you end up being on the Balmoral estate in a small little outhouse, which is where the Queen's had a photograph taken.
Well, I've been to Windsor Castle. I've been to Buckingham Palace. Doesn't mean that I'm a sex offender or even a victim. So the point is, there was evidence that's been presented that we didn't know about. There's evidence that was presented that we expected, but we didn't get. The surprises will continue with the defense case. The big question will be whether or not Ghislaine Maxwell herself gives evidence. She doesn't have to.
Yeah, what do you think? We've talked about this. Do you think, seeing how it's gone so far this week, if you were looking to represent Ghislaine, would you say go in the box or not?
I think my judgment would be, I would look at the jury and how the jury have responded to the evidence given so far. But the defense community will tell you this, that they really do advise their clients not to give evidence. It's for the prosecution to prove, not for you to disprove. You're innocent until you're proven guilty. And therefore, don't make it easier for them by giving evidence. But the point is that Ghislaine Maxwell, remembering that I did meet her 25 years ago, she's a very charming, very articulate, intelligent. Then maybe they want to see that. Maybe they want to put that across to the jury. That, you know, she's not somebody that
has been groomed. There are pros to going in the box, isn't there? You know, if you've got someone who is very clear and is likely to win the jury over in some of what they say, then that could be a very beneficial thing to do.
Absolutely.
You run the risk.
The fact is, though, she has not today given an account of her relationship with Jeffrey Epstein. Yeah. And if she were, you know, I think there'd be greater, more downsides, to put it bluntly, than there are upsides. Yes. But that's a judgment call they will have to make. And of course, their client doesn't have to take her.
Because if she goes in the box, she's going to be asked to give an account. She's going to be asked those questions. Whereas if she doesn't go in the box, she can just remain silent as she has been so far.
Exactly. I mean, it's not for her to prove the case. You know, people remember, it's not for her. It's for the prosecution to prove it. But the prosecution could say, you know, members of the jury, she had the opportunity to tell you an innocent explanation for absolutely everything, and she chose not to. You know, so those are the kinds of questions, those are the kinds of judgments you have to make, a balancing exercise you have to make. I'm not persuaded that she will, but at the same time, you know, who knows with her.
And with the exception of the photograph, we haven't really seen any names mentioned. We've had some mentions of the Clintons because of the travel, and Trump in relation to travel again in the play. But no focus on that. And I wonder, if you were a defence, would you look to do that? Or would you just simply say, well, they've not really come up now, we'll just move on? Because the key to the defence position, of course, is it's her defence. So she will, the defence lawyers will be presenting the case that she wants presented.
Absolutely. You know, do you want to make it more salacious than it is by giving names of all sorts of other people that might be involved? You know, the jury, you know, you want to make it as simple as possible for the jury to acquit your client, you know, to find her not guilty, and from the defense's perspective. And the, you know, the jury will see, if the jury heard many more names coming out of her mouth, for example, or from defense witnesses, I have no doubt they'll be thinking, this is so salacious. These people are up to no good, you know? And that's not an impression you want to leave the jury with.
What's your thought about televising TV trials? Because, of course, the one case that's been very significant in my career was Oscar Pistorius. And I have got to know Oscar very well and was over there whilst the trial was going on. And it is the only trial to date that's been heard publicly via television. And in fact, there's been a number of cases since where applications have been made for it to be televised and they've turned it down. It is unique and it stands on its own. What's your thought?
Well, I'm very much in favour of it. I mean, I sometimes, when I'm really bored at midnight, I will watch court TV from the United States of America and have a good laugh. But, you know, the point is, the courts are exercising justice in the name of you and I, the public. And in the old days, Mark, they were the theatre. You know, the public galleries were full of members of the public who had nothing else to do, but who went along and watched justice being done in their name. Now, if you went into a public gallery anywhere, you'd find it empty virtually. Nobody goes anymore. So, and the technology is now available for live streaming. We should be able to see what's happening, subject to all the rules about anonymity and vulnerable witnesses. You should be able to see everything that happens in your name as a member of the public, paid for by you as a taxpayer. But also, it builds confidence. It does two things, actually. It builds confidence in the justice system, that you can see that justice is being done and seen to be done. That's the word, seen to be done. But also, it then has an impact on the professionals. They need to up their game. But, you know, you look at what happens in America. We discussed this before. In the old days, trials used to take 4 or 5 days. Now they take 4 or 5 weeks. You know, the professionals, if they knew they were being observed all the time, I think they would up their game. They wouldn't mess around with the ums and ahs and turning their paper over and pages over and ask for a 5-minute break for this, that, and the other. So I think it would have a significant impact on public confidence and professional capability. It's a no-brainer to me. Get the courtrooms televised now.
Yeah. And do you think it'll happen?
It happens in bits and bobs. You know, the Supreme Court obviously is televised. Scotland has had a pilot. It needs a brave minister, justice minister. We haven't got one right now, but it needs a brave justice minister to say, right, I'm going to make it happen. Because the judiciary will stand and say, no, no, no. The professionals will detest it. You know, but can you think of another profession which doesn't allow cameras in? You got all those programs about surgery and doctors.
Yeah, everywhere
vets,
now. Isn't
vets it? Allow cameras in. Shops allow cameras, but the courts don't come anywhere near us. You know, and we rely upon a 1925 bit of legislation to prevent even photographs being taken. So
it's quite a lot of bastille of secrecy still, isn't it? I mean, the whole jury system is archaically kept in terms of, you don't know what goes on within that jury system. And for a long time, I've had a concern that if you are an influential person as the foreperson on that jury, you can take people on the journey with you. You can persuade people to find someone guilty of jury, innocent.
Point of a jury, you have 12 people who come to a resolution, and there will be stronger voices. There'll be as long as they follow the evidence. That's the most important thing. It doesn't matter how they get the final outcome. I wouldn't want cameras in a jury room. You know, if you and I had a camera on us while we were talking, we would be different to you and I talking without a camera on us. Particularly when they're, but you know, the actual hearing itself should be televised. It should be live streamed. It should happen everywhere and anywhere. Whether you're bored enough to watch it or not is entirely up to you. But it's your choice.
Yeah. Well, I think I agree, but I don't think I'll see it happening in my time.
Yeah. If I was Justice Minister, it'll be my first policy.
Well, there we are. So with Justice Minister, would that be the role that you'd like? If you got,
no,
if
not,
you got a politician, what role would you like?
I'm not interested in party politics. I'm afraid it doesn't interest me. But you know, my point is that there are some good politicians out there. And I hope that they are not just listening to our podcast, but they are listening to the wide birth that we're giving them, the wide, you know, information we're seeking from them, telling them, we're begging them, please show us what happens in our name. And that will have the biggest impact on public confidence and the performance of our justice system than anything else I can think of.
Nazir, another great conversation. So next week, we're going to talk about the lack of action by police.
Absolutely. We need to confront the perception now that there are certain crimes and certain behaviours by certain people that will never be investigated by the police, and understand why that might be the case. And of course, call it out where it needs to be called out.
And we need to dig around that, because there is real anger, particularly around the government's lack of action in terms of breach of COVID, the Metropolitan Police's response to that, all at a time when we know that the variant is causing real problems.
Yeah, real people are suffering, but they, at the same time, they're thinking, hang on a minute, if I was a senior leader in government or in politics or in public life, I wouldn't have any consequences at all if I broke these regulations.
So join us next week when we will be discussing the lack of action by the police in relation to certain cases, and a very full and frank discussion between Nazir and myself. Well, thank you for listening again. Thank you very much, Nazir, and see you next week.
Bye now.
Thank you for listening. I hope you've enjoyed this week's podcast. Do please tell your true crime friends, and it's important that you subscribe to our channel. If you've got any thoughts, or you just simply want to get in touch, you can do so via our Twitter page, Fear or Favour, or go to our website, www.fearorfavour.com. The series is edited by Martin Kayes, the music by Dylan Epega. Fear or Favour is an original true crime podcast in association with Audioboom.